From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the power of interfaith dialogue and look at an example of it here in Milwaukee. Then we'll hear from an indigenous chef opening a restaurant this week in Wisconsin.
I just want a fun, energetic place with really great food and to have people come in with an open mind and be able to learn something and take something home with them that they'll be able to hopefully pass on to others.
Plus, we'll speak with two chefs featured in Visit Milwaukee's new series, Good Things Brewing.
Milwaukee is very unique. It definitely provides a platform for storytellers. You know, our medium is food. We tell stories through our food.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Interfaith dialogue can break down barriers and create understanding. One of the first Islamic-Christian dialogues in the country took place here in Milwaukee in the 1980s. A collaboration between a Muslim UW-Milwaukee professor and two Franciscan sisters fostered spaces for interfaith dialogue. It was done in an effort to help people of different religious backgrounds understand each other better. That dialogue is the subject of a book co-edited by Marquette University professor Irfan Omar and his former student, Caitlin Daly. They joined WUWM's Eddie Morales to share the dialogue's history and its lasting impact.
So together, you co-edited a book called Interfaith Engagement in Milwaukee, A Brief History of Christian-Muslim Dialogue. Irfan, can you tell me about your interest in the subject and what led to the creation of that book?
Right. Yeah, I've been interested in interfaith engagement for a while. And over the years at Marquette, I developed some courses at the undergraduate level and at the graduate level to sort of expose my interest and what's happening in the world of dialogue to my students. And I believe that interfaith dialogue, interfaith engagement, interfaith relationships are important for peacemaking. They're important for our time. They are important for our country. They are important for our world. And so my interest is both academic and personal.
Caitlin, what is your involvement in this book? And at the time, what year was it when this was sort of being researched and being developed?
Yeah, so also similar to Dr. Omar, mine is both academic and personal. So I was a nursing student at Marquette, and I think I was in my junior or senior year when Dr. Omar offered this course on Muslim-Christian dialogue, and it was a graduate level course at the time. But due to my interest in nursing being very holistic and trying to understand how does spiritual health impact all sorts of levels of health, mental health, social health, physical health. I immediately developed kind of an interest in the intersections of health and religion. And so I was also a double major in theology. And I always have been interested in a more also holistic view of theology and what does it look like to learn and understand and integrate world religions together. And so at the time of the course that was offered by Dr. Omar in Muslim-Christian dialogue, I took that, and it was a small class of about 5 to 6 other folks. And our final projects were essentially the origin of this book. It was trying to understand what the history of Muslim-Christian dialogue looked like in Milwaukee. And from the course onward, we graduated, we wrote our final papers, and we decided, hey, this might make a great book. And so there were additional efforts that came afterwards that led to the culmination of what this book is.
Milwaukee is home to one of the first Islamic Christian dialogues in the country. Can you tell me about its founders and the impact that it had beyond Milwaukee?
In many countries, many cities, many communities, and I think almost every religious tradition has some sort of program, some sort of extension of their religious activities that involve interfaith connections, interfaith relation building, and so on. When we were looking at the theoretical aspects, we actually learned that historically there was a dialogue in Milwaukee. So we became curious about it and we learned about it. And it so happened that we met the three people who started that dialogue in 1980. And we were amazed to find out that according to many religious leaders at that time in the 1980s, they thought this dialogue was very exemplary. That was a model because it was structured, it was respectful, it involved, you know, all different kinds of people, not just clergy, not just professors, but all, you know, people from all walks of life. And then beyond that, they were interested in not just religious conversation, but a conversation that was primarily human. You know, what do we experience? What are the problems we face together? What can we do about them? And so here's a religious solution to human problems. So that's what really attracted me to document it. And we still give credit to religion and theology and religious communities because they did a lot to make that happen.
And what are the names of those co-founders?
Dr. Abbas Hamdani, he was a history professor at UWM, and Sister Jacine Reese, she was a sister in the Franciscan tradition, and before that, or together with her, was Sister Lucille Walsh, and these two sisters were also professors at
Cardinal Stritch University.
Cardinal Stritch University. So they were teaching religion courses, they were teaching theology courses, but they took a course with Dr. Hamdani. And then they realized they know nothing about Islam. They had learned about, you know, other religions a little bit. So they then said, let's start a dialogue that will involve community members and also students and you know, just do a whole community-wide project.
Caitlin, what was really important about the impact that that had beyond Milwaukee? Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, like Dr. Omar had said, I mean, worldwide, there was recognition that the Muslim-Christian dialogue was ongoing. I think it was a seed for a lot of interfaith efforts being recognized by such large institutions like the Catholic Church. So these sisters were Catholic, you know, sisters, and we have in the book evidence of letters that they had written to the Vatican at the time, talking about the dialogue, receiving support for the dialogue. And so historically, it just was a really monumental seed that was planted to give birth to a lot of interfaith events that came after that. And not even just events, but also the acceptance of and encouragement of interfaith relationships and engagements. In terms of my interest that I took with the impact it had in present day, as a student, I was really interested in understanding the role of universities and institutions that just gather a large amount of people who do come from a variety of different backgrounds. And so Marquette being predominantly Catholic, obviously there was, you know, already a religious kind of imperative to the university. And I was interested coming from still Christian, but a different denomination. I was Lutheran growing up, trying to understand what are these ecumenical relationships, so inter-Christian relationships that can be established among students and peers, but then expanding that to understanding, you know, there's not just Christians on this campus, we have people of all different religions. So how do we understand that we are interacting and integrating as students in classrooms and beyond? What does that say about how we can also engage in a more formal sense when we do have maybe our religions more at the forefront of those interactions? So, you know, when it comes to putting religion at the forefront of these interactions, how do we still just keep the human at the center and at the core of those interactions?
And Irfan, what does this type of work and research do to help with what Caitlin just spoke about?
Well, it does a great deal for civil society, you know, so religion is always blamed for a lot of problems in the world and also in America. But I think it's interesting that we don't get a perspective that shows religion's contribution to building civil society and addressing problems. And so those kind of social issues were addressed by these communities. But on the whole, what they did for the Milwaukee community, and I'm sure that, you know, this is replicated in many other countries and cities and communities, is that they reduced the fear of the other. They allowed for bridge building. They allowed for people to have conversation. They, in fact, made it possible for groups to say, yeah, the different is not necessarily bad. Difference can be celebrated. So I think at the root of it, even though they're talking about religious issues or human issues, at the root of it, they were addressing really that, you know, the forces that bring people together.
You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Eddie Morales, speaking with guests Irfan Omar and Caitlin Daly, co-editors of Interfaith Engagement in Milwaukee. How did students conduct research for this work, and what types of documents helped detail the story?
So the students that were part of the class, used a mix of understanding information, gathering information from texts that were available, so literature, so to speak. And then we also conducted interviews with the Milwaukee activists that were engaged in this interfaith work. And so that was both historical documentation, such as from Sister Jessine, who was alive at the time and allowed us to interview her and gather the documents that she had, but also looking at present day ongoings by such organizations such as the Interfaith Conference in Milwaukee, and understanding, you know, there was a plethora of people that were a part of that organization that we were able to connect with and understand the ongoing events at the time. So a mix of different types of research methods that did allow us to gather a good source of data for the chapters.
Was there anything that was discovered, or in thinking back to that, is there anything for either of you to speak on when it comes to something that was very impactful or surprising?
For me, the most surprising thing was that many people in Muslim and Christian communities, and even you could say other religious communities, they are not aware what their religious traditions are asking them to do with regard to the other, right? I mean, the different. So we've learned things, you know, in terms of race relations, we are still learning. We learned things in terms of cultural differences. There is very little in the secular space, in the media community, that speaks about religious difference. And when they speak about religious difference, usually that is contextualized within some kind of a violent event. What these groups did was to turn that paradigm and say, we were not going to wait until some kind of a violent event to talk about religious peacemaking. We're going to talk about it proactively. I think that was really empowering, not necessarily surprising, but empowering for me.
I would say one of the compelling things that was surprising to me related to what Dr. Omar said is the amount of self-awareness I learned throughout the process of not even just being in the Muslim Christian Dialogue course, but then also in the process of writing the book and in speaking to a lot of people who were strong in the interfaith efforts, was this idea of like the sense of self, starting to understand what Dr. Omar spoke to of your own tradition and your own values and what is guiding you. I think I went into the conversations, both for the interviews, but also just into the interfaith dialogues that I attended myself, going into those wanting to just learn more, to be open to hearing what other people had to say, to learn about them, to value the differences. But I didn't realize really like that there was a lot in my own faith journey that I hadn't quite wrestled with or understood. And while it is okay to attend interfaith events, you know, questioning or not knowing, it also made me realize that there was a deeper conviction that I had to really want to know, what is it that I've been taught? What did I grow up with? Where do I stand on it now? And how does that integrate into these things that I'm learning, or maybe not integrate? And then how do I reconcile those differences? So it was really, it's a journey of learning and being with alongside others, but it's also a journey of being with alongside yourself to understand what's moving in you and what is it from your faith tradition that has brought you to the point you are. And so that for me was an interesting piece that I'm still working on and learning about today.
Is there anything that either of you would like to add?
Well, I would say thank you for doing this program, because I think speaking about interfaith is very important in today's world. Interfaith allows us to sort of have conversations at the intersections of religion, theology, philosophy, society, politics, culture, history, and so much more. And I think so they're rich conversations. And using that lens doesn't mean we have to be particularly ideological about one religion or the other. In fact, in today's society, doing interfaith doesn't even necessitate that you are part of a sort of, you know, following a certain religious tradition. Although, for me, it makes sense to have that aspect. You know, interfaith does include faith, right? But there are secular groups who are doing interfaith because of the reasons that I mentioned, because they allow the conversation to be enriched by every aspect that we are facing in our lives. One other thing I would say is that we do have plans to publish a second revised edition of the book that is going to be coming out in late 2023. And it would include a sort of a short chapter on how interfaith continued during the pandemic.
I'll add as a final end that I want to speak on the piece about fear and how a lot of interfaith work is overcoming fear and undoing fear that's been deeply embedded in our societies and our families and our friend groups. And I think, but part of that, getting to that point where you are in an interfaith dialogue or at an interfaith event, is having the courage to go to it or to step up and have that bravery to do so, which for a very valid number of reasons could, that fear could be present, and that's understandable. But I also just wanted to echo that to, it takes courage to get into those spaces, and I encourage folks to try to seek out those spaces. There are, as Dr. Omar said, several interfaith groups and events, both secular and faith-based, that exist, and on a variety of topics of social issues that are very prevalent for today: racial issues, environmental issues, health. So there's a variety of angles in which you can be involved that align with your interests as well. And so I encourage listeners to seek those opportunities, do some Google searching, look on social media engines, and just to find the right fit for you if you're interested in exploring what this work is.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, again, for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Thank you, Eddie.
Irfan Omar is an associate professor of theology at Marquette University. He co-edited the book Interfaith Engagement in Milwaukee, A Brief History of Christian-Muslim Dialogue, along with his former student, Caitlin Daly. They both spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. This week, the restaurant Mejum opens in LaPointe, Wisconsin, on Madeline Island in Lake Superior. Mejum, which is Ojibwe for food, is an indigenous restaurant that serves modern, seasonal Ojibwe fare, using meats like venison, bison, and rabbit, alongside ingredients like wild rice, island mushrooms, and ramps. Bryce Stevenson is the chef of Mejum. He grew up on the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Reservation, and he's part of a growing food sovereignty movement among indigenous chefs. WUWM's Lena Tran speaks with Chef Stevenson about what he hopes to accomplish with the restaurant.
You are about to open Mejum this week. I understand it's your first restaurant. Tell me about your vision for the place. What do you want it to be?
What I want Mejum to be is a place that, well, one, represents the Shequamagon Bay Area. It represents Red Cliff Tribe, it represents Bad River Tribe, it represents all the Ojibwe tribes that once originated from the island and were forcibly removed. And I want to sort of reclaim a little spot on the island with our traditional foods, and to take those foods and just make them accessible to everybody, to indigenous people and tourists and locals alike. I just want a fun, energetic place with really great food, and to have people come in with an open mind and be able to learn something and take something home with them that they'll be able to hopefully pass on to others.
Do you feel like that's something there that you see on the island, or does this feel kind of like breaking new ground for the Madeline Island scene?
I mean, honestly, in my personal opinion, the island's overrun with tourism, summer homes. There aren't a lot of great expressions of Ojibwe culture in any fashion. There's hints of it. You'll see some of the streets here are bilingually labeled, so they'll be labeled in Anishinaabemowin as well as English. And we do have the Madeline Island Museum here, which does a great job in trying to explain the origins of the fur trade and sort of the mixture of indigenous peoples with the French in this spot. But beyond that, there's nothing. There's no food representation here. There's no art representation here. There's just no solid representation that says there are natives on this island still and they're thriving.
Given that it is such a tourist destination in the summertime, but it's in this like culturally significant place, do you see your role or like feel some pressure to be an educator with the restaurant? What is that feeling like?
I really think that's always been a reality I had to face with a project like this. I formed the clear picture of Neejim and what I wanted it to be very long ago. Like when I first started cooking, when I first got into a kitchen and started falling in love with the art of it, I had already had this name and this concept and this place I've already picked out. So I think the ultimate goal is to just teach people that, yes, we have a different culture, and yes, I just want to break people away from the stereotypes of indigenous peoples. You know, especially in this area, there's still many, many people who look at us in a very negative light and think of us as just subservient workers who, you know, they keep the inns and the restaurants running, but they're not any better for that. And I want people to see that there's passion and creativity and art and just this beautiful culture that is just thriving in this area that the average tourist, when they come here, they don't see it. They see the main attractions and, you know, they might stop in the casino and come to a preconceived misconception about indigenous people there. But I want them to have a better understanding of who we are and, you know, why we are a significant addition to this area and the earth.
What's been some of the inspiration as you're putting this new menu together?
My inspiration is always what is the best that I can get right now. With Neejim, there won't be any big trucks pulling up with big orders of produce and frozen pieces of whatever. It's coming, you know, from local farmers. We work on a tier system, which is try to source from indigenous peoples first. We have foragers and farmers and fishers and try to make an indigenous first. And if we can't find something specifically from that source, we, you know, try to go local. Who's on the island growing what? Just as local as we can get it. Worst case scenario, you know, our bottom line is organic. At least we want to make sure we have the best quality food. And based on that, the menu will change. It could change as much as every day, every couple of days, but we want to be able to bring in the best of what the season and the area has to offer. And then as it changes, we change with it. So that's the main inspiration.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Can you talk about some of the indigenous producers or growers that you've kind of been able to connect with throughout this process?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. One of my favorites is Ramona Farms. They're not in this area. They are down in Arizona, but they are an indigenous farm that grows different varieties of tepary beans. And that's my favorite bean. And so sort of more locally, we have Red Cliff Fish Company, which is a tribally owned fishery in Red Cliff, my tribe. And so getting fresh lake fish from an indigenous source for an indigenous restaurant is just what, something that makes me just always smile. And then another great one is Cheyenne River Buffalo Company, Cheyenne River Tribe. And, you know, their bison product is just, it's just an incredible product that a lot of indigenous chefs make sure that they go there for.
This is WWM's Lena Tran. I'm speaking with Chef Bryce Stevenson. He is the chef of Neejim, which is an Ojibwe restaurant opening in La Pointe, Wisconsin on Madeline Island this week. How did you get into the industry? Or when did you get into cooking and kind of discover that this is what you wanted to do?
I was definitely a late bloomer in the industry. I had a lot of what I would call past lives for, you know, as young as I am. I get bored easily. And, you know, when I'm learning something, if I learn it and there's not more to learn, I get too bored and I want to move on to something else that I can fill my mind with. I used to be a carpenter. I used to be a letter pressman. I was a graphic designer. I was a tree and shrub specialist for a summer, you know, just across the board with, you know, trying to figure out what's making me happy. All this while I'm going to school at UWM. And, you know, studying English and Indigenous studies. And I got sick of framing houses. I needed a break physically. And there's a little restaurant opening by my house called Hello Falafel. It just seemed really cool. It was done by the owners of Odd Duck, Ross and Melissa in Milwaukee. And I saw it. I thought it'd be cool to meet some people and, you know, learn a little bit more about cooking. I worked at McDonald's in, you know, high school, just like a lot of people. When I started there, everything was from scratch. So as soon as I walk in, I'm learning how to make, you know, Israeli pickles, and I'm learning how to make, you know, laffa bread, and, you know, just all these things that are just 100% from scratch. And I just I fall in love with it so, so hard. it was just one of those things where it was just, I felt like there was no way I could stop learning. No matter how far out you stretch, there's a million little things that are just going to come crawling at you with ideas and flavors and scents. And it just, I wasn't able to look back after that.
Yeah. You said earlier that you got into this like kind of late in life. I'm curious, like, what your relationship with food and dining was like growing up. And I don't know, did you have an inkling of it now looking back that your life might have gone this way?
So as a kid, and you know, Indigenous people will connect to this very easily, but we grew up on commodities, and so it was just canned vegetables, canned meats, just dry goods, everything USDA, just dry, no possibility of going bad. And it just makes us sick, you know, diabetes, heart disease, all of that just rampant. And you know, so when we were kids, my mom, that's how she cooked. She would open up a couple cans of this and that, throw it in a pot and say, that's dinner, you know? And it was never very pleasant, but it was food. When sort of things started getting rough for my mom and her marriage when I was younger, she had ended up working a lot up here. And so she was working three jobs, just night and day. And so there was five of us, and I had to cook a lot. You know, I had to cook dinner for, you know, my siblings so that we had stuff to eat, and I learned how to clean at that age. And, you know, it was a little younger than I'd say most kids are when they learn those kind of life skills. But since that, like I've always been very self-sufficient. I've always cooked for myself, and, you know, was never a great cook, but, you know, I still try to make things tasty. You know, it was mostly packaged ramen and just white rice, but you know, you try to, what can I add to this to make it a little better? It was about flavor. It's like, how can I make it good? That's how I was until, honestly, I met my wife 15 years ago, and she's Italian through and through, and being with her family and cooking with her grandparents and seeing, again, that sort of scratch cooking, like that had a big impact on me. That changed the way I looked at food. And if it wasn't for that, I would never have traveled down a path where I would even go to Odd Duck to try it, because it would just be too strange for me or too unapproachable, because I'm used to eating Hamburger Helper and Rice-A-Roni. So, so that was definitely very significant. It was something that I instantly wish that my own family had, and that more people in my reservation had, with those food traditions where you sit around the table and you talk and you laugh and you make this, or you eat this food that took all day to make from scratch. And, you know, I want people to be inspired to be able to do that. And that's why I wanted to do everything I can to bring Indigenous food, to highlight it in this area.
Culturally appropriate, like healthy food, you know, what you've just described remains a barrier in many Indigenous communities. I wonder, like, is there a tension? Do you feel any kind of tension between that reality and like what you offer as a chef?
The role I want to play is to take those foods that are strange, even to Indigenous peoples. You know, there's still so many Indigenous ingredients that I've never tried myself that I'm trying to get my hands on. But what I want to do is just take those things and make them more approachable, kind of turn them into, you know, there's a familiarity in, say, this dish. There's something familiar and comforting in this dish, but there's also something unfamiliar and that I don't know. And that's where their brains are going to spark and start to, you know, like, oh, what is this? How is it made? How is it? And then they're going to have more understanding about that ingredient. I'm excited and, for lack of a better word, proud, I guess you could say, of what's happening up here. You know, with my bouncing around and moving around the country and trying to learn, when I came back here, there are so many more efforts. It is nowhere near enough, but there are so many more efforts to reintroduce these flavors and ingredients to tribal people. You know, for example, you know, I want to be able to come in with my team and show people, like, this is what you can do with them. These are, you know, some of the flavors you can pull out of these, or the techniques that you can use for game meats or root vegetables, or, you know, so for me, it's an exciting time to be finally able to get this project going, because I definitely didn't have anything close to this when I was growing up.
Bryce Stevenson is the chef of Mijum. He spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran about his new restaurant that opens on Thursday. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Milwaukee is home to one of the largest communities of Myanmar refugees in the U.S. Later in the show, we'll explore what one local supermarket is bringing to the community. But first, we'll speak with two local chefs highlighted in the first episode of the new Good Things Brewing series from Visit Milwaukee, which highlights people and places in the city. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Good things are brewing in Milwaukee, and Visit Milwaukee has launched a new TV series to share these stories of positivity. Good Things Brewing seeks to show what makes Milwaukee a great place to live through the eyes of some of the city's most interesting residents. We're partnering with Visit Milwaukee and speaking with some of the guests on Good Things Brewing. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Paul Bartolotta of the Bartolotta Restaurants and Jesus Gonzalez of Zocalo Food Truck Park. They're both featured in the first episode. Gonzalez begins by sharing how he first met Chef Bartolotta.
You know what's funny? I don't think I've ever shared this anecdote, but the first time I met Chef Bartolotta was at the Culinary Institute of America. Chef, you were there. I believe you were a judge at the Bocuse d'Or, and there was a competition going on.
Mm-hmm.
This was years ago. I mean, yeah. 31. That was when I was like 18 years old. You were a judge, and as soon as I heard your name, that you were a guest judge, I was like, this is amazing. I mean, growing up and hearing the Bartolottas in Milwaukee was a big deal. And the fact that he was the closest thing that I would get to Milwaukee, being out there and just being homesick, it was awesome.
Yeah.
So I introduced myself. You know, you probably don't remember me because, I mean, so many kids in white, you know, white chef coats. But it was a great experience.
Well, you were very fortunate because you went to, you know, I love MATC and it does great work. But probably the premier culinary academy in America has to be the Culinary Institute of America. So he started at the top of the line. And you know, I've taught some master classes out in CIA Greystone, and I've done a bunch of different things at the CIA. But it's an incredible school, and I've watched it grow from my days in New York in the late 80s. So nice that you remember that, but I'm still very active with Bocuse d'Or. And supporting, mentoring young chefs to grow beyond, and also for Team USA that competes in the Culinary Olympics in Lyon every 2 years.
That's fantastic. And to go to the Culinary Institute and also just decide to come back home, what was kind of your inspiration or kind of your guiding mission that led you to where you are today?
Right. So when I left, I was 17 years old. I was very young, and I was very eager to just get a different perspective. Going to New York kind of gave me my independence. I learned so much about myself. And so through my experience at the Culinary Institute of America, I was able to work abroad. I did an internship out in Spain. I was able to travel to China for about 3 weeks, learn about the culture, the cuisine. And through that experience, I realized that, you know, Milwaukee is very unique. And I think it definitely provides a platform for storytellers. And I think we just, you know, our medium is food. We tell stories through our food. And so I was eager to come back and just tell that story.
And Paul, similarly, you've worked in kitchens around the world as well. What keeps you coming back to Milwaukee to continue to grow and develop what you have here?
So my father said when we were growing up, you know, home is not a place to run away from. It's a place to come home to. And my father encouraged all of the kids to leave. Milwaukee will be here. Go see the world. see where you're happy, and then maybe you'll think about where you grew up and then come home. And in my case, I was in Italy for 6-7 years cooking. I was in France for 1.5 years, and I came back and opened a restaurant in New York and then took over a restaurant in Chicago, Spiaggia. And then in 93, my brother called me to do restaurants up in Milwaukee. And it was a dream come true for me. When I was over in Italy, I would be writing him letters. Joe, you and I should do something together as a team. I'll do the back, you do the front. And it was something that actually came to fruition. And then I had an opportunity to go to Las Vegas with Steve Wynn. I did that as well. Meanwhile, I continued to develop and build restaurants with my brother. And sadly, when my brother passed in 2019, we were already discussing, you know, my coming actually home definitively to Milwaukee. Didn't want to come back on those terms, but, you know, spent a lot of time developing these restaurants with my brother and the culture of our organization and our team. And we've just watched Milwaukee grow, and not only in the diverse neighborhoods, whether it's Greendale or Mequon or you know, downtown Milwaukee or Wauwatosa, but also just in the diversity of what's going on, what young guys like Jesus is doing, like amazing stuff, really exciting. And it just there's an energy around the various neighborhoods in Milwaukee and the cuisine. And you really said it extremely well. You know, when we look at a restaurant, we break it down into three main components: the environment in which the guest enjoys, the food and beverage offerings that we serve them, and then obviously hospitality and the relationship building you build. But it all gets connected through the theme that he mentioned, which is so critical. It's the journey.
Well, and I love talking to the both of you and seeing just, maybe it's a different place on the matter of scale, but it's the commonality of that experience of having the dishes.
No, I'm just really old compared to him. That's the big difference. He's got a lot more spring in his step.
Well, and, you know, with that commonality of like, this is the foundation of what you both do, no matter what, is delivering a quality experience to people. And also a main thing is supporting the people who work for you. So at Zocalo, it's not just a place for food trucks. You also support your vendors and, you know, kind of guide and coach them. So why is that an important part for you in your business?
Yeah. You know, working with other food entrepreneurs, that's our core. That's how we got started. During my experience of being at First in Pittsburgh, that's where I started to meet these young food entrepreneurs that had a food truck or were talking about getting a food truck. So they were sharing their visions of, you know, what they wanted to accomplish, and they wanted to do it with me on First in Pittsburgh. But unfortunately, we couldn't do that because we just didn't have the correct, you know, permits to do so, right? And so we started, you know, my business partner and I decided, well, why don't we look for a space where we can build this platform, right? Where we could come and invite more entrepreneurs to come and start their businesses. And through that process, you know, we opened up in 2019. A few years now, like, we've been able to see.
Great timing. Perfect timing.
Right. 9 months right before the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
You know,
Trial by fire.
Absolutely. And we've been able to see the evolution of these food entrepreneurs from idea to execution to growth, which is probably what motivates us the most to keep doing it.
And in our end, and I look back 30 years because Ristorante Bartolotti in Wauwatosa, in the village of Wauwatosa, had its 30th anniversary. Are you 30 yet?
Just checking. 31, yeah.
We were in our first year of business when he was born. wow. But when I look back on the day, I remember being down in the prep kitchen below and Peter Maki coming downstairs and saying, you know, your brother sent me down here to see what, you know, products you need. And I said, you know, I need fresh basil. I need fresh rosemary. I need this. I made a list of all these products. And he looks at me, Paul, listen, you may have that in Chicago. I said, but we don't have that in Milwaukee. And I sort of tapped him on the shoulder and said, start driving, Peter. And he laughed. But, you know, back in the day, he was starting out. Peter Maki, Tony Maki Protos had, you know, a van or two, and now they have a fleet of trucks. So we view our role in, you know, we touch so many different people's lives. When we see young chefs that come through our, or managers come and open their own restaurants, it's prideful for us. When we see people come through and share a couple of years of their life but go on to become a doctor because they paid through school or whatever it is, they shared a moment of their lives with us. And in the cumulatively, each one of those people made our business better. And it's the same with our vendors. We, you know, we talk a lot in our leadership team. It's like, don't call your vendor and complain because something isn't perfect. Don't forget to call them when it's exceptional and support their business.
Right. And I know that Good Things Brewing. Was this the first time that brought the two of you together at the end of the episode when you both met?
I had the pleasure of meeting him for the first time.
Outside of the Culinary Institute. First meeting.
Yeah, that I regret not remembering. I apologize.
But no, yes. That was the first time we were.
It was an honor to meet him. It was a pleasure.
So, and obviously that's grown into what seems like a very good relationship here. And how would you both describe Milwaukee's food scene and like the community among its chefs? What's it like for you guys being in the midst of it?
I think the one thing that brings us together is that we just understand the amount of sacrifice and the determination or just how resilient this community is. Like, that brings us together. You know, we're in the trenches together. You know, this is our second year out of the pandemic. You know, it was tough, right? And I think what helped us get through it was that community of food entrepreneurs at Zocalo. So we lean on each other when we need it. And we support each other. We try to empower one another so that we can continue to grow.
And I'd echo that 100%. We, you know, losing my brother in 19 was an enormous personal loss, but it was also a loss of my business partner. And quite honestly, Joe had always been the face of the company. By design, I always sort of stayed behind. I think I did myself a disservice because now I'm sort of reintroducing people to the company that I've been part of for 30 years. But it was something that people, they saw Joe, and Joe was larger than life. And so I said to somebody, you know, impossible shoes to fill. And somebody said, no, don't fill them. Just where he stopped walking, you just got to keep continuing. And I kind of like that, like to build on his legacy. And so when I think about all the different people that have come through and then how they've gone out and opened their restaurants, a lot of people called, for advice or things like this during the pandemic. But conversely, I was listening and asking them a lot of questions. How are you handling this? Because the answer is none of us have all the answers. This is a really complicated business. And so there's a camaraderie. The competitive, you know, I tell everybody there are way too many restaurants in Milwaukee, but I'm a restaurateur. I want no competition. We're in the business of business. But conversely, it only forces everyone to get better. So truly, I mean, if I think back 30 years, it is remarkable what is happening in Milwaukee. And I couldn't be more proud. So when they talked about including, you know, food guys on Good Things Brewing, to me, it was an honor because I think restaurants are much more than just a place to go eat. I think they actually create community. And therefore, we all, and you customers out there listening, you know, support your local restaurant because there's a lot of great people that live within these restaurants that are here to give you pleasure and take care of you and serve you and make amazing food for you and welcome you and recognize you. And that is what community is about.
That was a great answer. Definitely love that.
Yeah. Community.
Paul Bartolotta is a chef and co-founder of the Bartolotta Restaurants. Jesus Gonzalez is a chef and co-owner of Zocalo Food Truck Park. They were featured in the first episode of Visit Milwaukee's Good Things Brewing series. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And you can find a link to that at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll head to Karen's Supermarket on Milwaukee's South Side and learn what it means for Myanmar refugees living in the city. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee has become home to a growing community of refugees from Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. Armed conflicts have been ravaging the nation for more than seven decades, often dividing people along ethnic lines. Milwaukee is thought to have the United States' largest community of Rohingya, a Muslim minority from Myanmar that's faced persecution and an ongoing genocide in their home country. Other groups like Burmese and Karen have faced similar persecution during this time of unrest. That was the case for Tupaw's family, which fled to a Thai refugee camp before making their way to the U.S. Pa is the owner of Karen's Supermarket on Milwaukee's South Side, a grocery store and meeting place for people in the community. I headed over to the supermarket to learn more about it. Thank you so much for chatting with me. So you said you really just started over here about 2-3 months ago.
Yeah, I started on around March 7th, I believe, of this year.
But you've lived in Milwaukee for a while now.
Uh-huh, yeah, I have lived in Milwaukee since 2018.
Mm-hmm. Where did you move from?
Originally, I was born in Tallinn refugee camp, and then I grew up there. We moved to American back in 2010. The first states I was living in was Dallas, Texas, and then after like a few years, we moved to Iowa, and then during the years of 2018, I moved here.
What brought you to Milwaukee specifically?
Not really sure. Families. Yeah.
It seems like there's a growing community here in Milwaukee.
Right.
Has that been helpful compared to other states? You said you lived in Iowa, you lived in...
Yeah, it's pretty helpful. You know, open up a grocery store, have your own community supporting you. It's a plus. And they like also want to make sure that they have what they need, what they're looking for. But yeah, I have seen a lot lately. We have a lot of Rohingya community, Karen community coming in. Yeah.
So what is, for people who won't know, what is the difference between the Karen community, the Rohingya community, the Burmese community?
Oh, okay, yeah. So, like, we have, like, I'm not really sure myself. Like, sure. I don't know the history, but we have, like, all kind of ethnic group who live in a refugee camp. So, like, my parents, they originally from Burma, but due to the civil war between Burma and Karen, then they flee to Tallinn back in, I think, 1995 or 1994, and I was born there in 1998 in the refugee camp. So a lot of like ethnic group moved to the refugee camps due to the war. They just want a little bit of freedom and stuff like that.
So this is a very diverse group of people.
Right.
I think we tend to lump everyone into kind of group, but there are so many different folks.
Yes, it is. Yeah, we have all, but most of us like understand the Burmese language, so we can kind of communicate with that.
Well, that's good news.
Right.
When you're trying to cater to what is a very diverse group of people, how do you do that with a grocery store? Because I'm sure everybody has slightly different preferences for what they want to eat, what they want to know.
Right. Yeah. So we just kind of like get feedback from customer. We ask like, you know, whatever, what kind of things they're looking for. Sometimes like they will come in, show me a picture, and then I'll just keep a photo of it, ask where I could get those. And then sometimes just bring in little by little, and then yeah.
Now, I notice you sell both clothing here and food. As I'm looking at the clothing, what am I looking at? Is this?
Yeah, these are, that's the Karen flag over there. These are men traditions shirts, and those are women traditional dress, clothing, shirts. But we usually, like, we don't really wear it day to day in these generations. But for, like, my parents and other the older generation, they do kind of wear this every day. But, like, for us, we wear them, like, during the special day, like, Revolution Days on, like, Sunday for going to church and stuff like that. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So as I'm looking around the store, you have so many things from different countries, different places. Mm-hmm. What are some of the items that you find people asking for most, where they're like, I just can't find this?
Right. Yeah, we have a lot of products that people would ask for, especially from Tallinn. It's hard to get, you know, like it's just so hard to find those stuff. Sometimes they'll just ask for like, because I think they just haven't had them for a long time. Sometimes veggies, sometimes we'll come to fruits that they haven't been eating for a long time, so they will kind of like ask for those. Yeah.
I've noticed, so I live not far from here, so I've come a few times, I think before you owned it as well.
Right.
And I've noticed that recently it seems like you started doing more hot food.
Right, yeah, so it's more of like daily to dates. We make them like daily. Those are like more of Burmese, Korean, like everyday like dessert things. So we have like some noodles, some sticky rice. Yeah, we just make kind of just a little bit of a menu.
It seems like a nice gathering place for people. Have you found more people are coming to the store and staying and sitting down and, you know, having a space?
Yeah, so like it's more kind of, it's a grocery store, but it's also like family friends friendly. Like sometimes people just come in, ask to, you know, have a seat waiting for whoever gonna pick them up. Sometimes they just come and have a chat. Yeah, very friendly family store, I guess.
What do you see as you look around the growing Burmese, Karen, Rohingya community? Mm-hmm. What do you see as your space inside of that community?
I have a lot of Korean community right now coming in, but I don't see a lot of like Burmese, Chinese, Korean, or Rohingya yet. So maybe they'll come in more often. Yeah.
Is there anything that you would say to people who are interested in checking out the space, interested in checking out the grocery store, but may not be as familiar with the cuisine?
Or... Oh, yeah. I have a lot of people from American and whoever, like they'll come and then I'll kind of like show them around if they want. And sometimes they're looking for a specific product. They'll just show me a picture and I will walk them through. So, yeah. I think communication is a big key if you want to like kind of get into like more with the diversity. So yeah, I think communications, being friendly, yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Sure, thank you.
Tupaw is the owner of Karen Supermarket at National and 27th on Milwaukee's South Side. At WUWM.com, you can find more stories related to Asian Americans in Milwaukee in honor of AAPI History Month. And that report wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. We're learning more about the future plans for the Milwaukee Public Museum, and we'll share that tomorrow. We'll also look at some things to do if you're planning a trip to Door County this summer. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.